We've been talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddhist teachings on meditation. We've been working our way through, and we've been spending some time last couple of weeks in the fourth foundation, and specifically in that fourth foundation, the Four Noble Truths. Tonight what we want to do is spend a little bit more time with the fourth noble truth, which is what's called the Eightfold Path, which is the way to live a life, the way to inhabit, to move through and in your world, your life, so that you realize your intrinsic inherent freedom. That's its purpose. Okay? It also makes complete, rational, pragmatic, scientific, common sense to understand the Fourth Noble Truth. Not to just understand it, but to live it. Okay? So it's very, very clear, and it covers every aspect of our life. Now you'll notice that as we go into this, it touches back into other aspects of the four foundations. It touches back into what mindfulness is, the purpose of concentration, effort. You might remember effort is one of the factors of enlightenment. Okay? So you can see again, as I mentioned before, that there is this a beautiful way, and it was probably quite intentional, I'm guessing, of overlapping these teachings. And I'm guessing that the purpose of that is so that there were different angles that people could come into this understanding. Okay. Now again, the meditation itself is not conceptual, although concepts do happen in our mind when we meditate. When meditation's really kicking in, okay, what happens is the space or the power of mindfulness, okay, like a light, shines upon that which is happening in such a way that it illuminates what's happening. So that what's happening, whatever that might be, the contents of the mind or the actual process, starts to become very, very clear. And this is what it means to see things clearly. This is what it means to have insight. And along with insights, which is direct, clear, intuitive, seeing things or experiencing things. You could use the word sensing if you like, as they really are. Also, you will have and often do have thoughts about what you've just experienced. Have you noticed this? Most people, if they have what they feel is a significant or powerful experience, or they see something, realize something, they often have thoughts about that shortly thereafter. And sometimes one's having an insight, and the thoughts jump in and start trying to understand the insight, and they sort of mess it up a little bit. They start getting in there, and, what was that? I just disappeared. What? And the mind has that tendency to be, for some of us more than others, wanting to understand things. This understanding, okay, the true understanding is not conceptual. It's experiential. It's like this whole thing, although this is only part of what we are, this whole thing groks the truth of something. It gets it. It goes like, oh, it's like a aha. It's a little bit difficult to describe this, but we've all experienced, to varying degrees, what an insight is. Okay? Vipassana, the word vipassana means insight. To see things truly, to see things as they actually are. Okay. So our foundation for a life of harmony and peace and realization, our foundation for that is ethical living. This is not moralistic. Okay? When I talk about ethical living, what I'm talking about is right speech, right action, right livelihood. Let's take it and look at it. See if it doesn't make complete sense. A livelihood that doesn't harm others. That doesn't engage in manipulation. So this is subtle because some people in the room or other people in life are attracted to the world of sales. And they have trained in how to sell something, for example. And they feel that it is a valid profession. But if it manipulates another person into doing something that they don't want to do, is it right livelihood? And certainly if I'm dealing in, let's say, drugs or arms. I'm selling arms. I'm making arms, or I'm selling arms. Armed, bombs and whatnot. This would be considered not right livelihood, because the motivation for why I'm doing what I'm doing, what is the motivation for doing what I'm doing? Okay, what happens is you get to look at, okay, obviously we all have a livelihood. It can evolve, it can change, we can do different jobs in our life. But you begin to see, is this in harmony? Okay, so when I was a young boy, I used to go fishing, and I loved it. And I would catch brook trout, and I would catch landlocked salmon in the mountains of Maine, and the rivers, and the streams, and the lakes, and stuff, and chop them up, no problem. You know, eat them, it was wonderful. Oh, yeah, fish, got a big fish, pull the guts out, the whole thing. After I'd been meditating for a while, and I hadn't been fishing for quite a while, I went back to the old summer camp, and I was fishing with my bobber and had a worm on there. I didn't quite like feel too deeply into, you know, putting the worm on, because if you put a worm on a hook, okay, and you go like this, it feels it. Get that right through you. And then it dies on the hook, or it stays partly alive. Okay. So I put it on, and I'm not particularly like tuned up to that, and I do my usual, you know. So it's not natural, it's habitual. We say, "Oh, that's naturally how I am." No. Till you see what you really are, you're not talking about what's natural, you're talking about what's habitual. Cast it out. Catch a fish. It's a smelt. Not that big of one, it's a rather long smelt, but you know, about like that size. Swallow the hook. And all of a sudden, like out of left field, I have this existential dilemma. I've pulled the hook out of fish before, just pull it right out. Kill the fish, right? Guts come out. I like, holy smokes. I'm stuck. I'm like majorly stuck on something that never bothered me at all before. Didn't even notice it. I don't know what to do. It's like all of a sudden it hits me. You pull the hook out, like you've been doing, kill the fish. Leave the hook in. Fish dies. Whew. And it starts hooking up real fast, and I'm like, oh my gosh. I don't know what to do. I start crying, I kind of break down a little bit. That doesn't help. But it happened. I'm feeling connected to this in a very disturbing manner. So I make a decision. I cut the line, and I'm just tracking what's happening inside, just enough to realize what I'm trying to do is escape this. Right? I'm trying to escape what's happening. So I take it, and I chuck it out. And I'm still crying, and my friend who's there is like got her arm on my shoulder, you know, kind of like crying. She's crying too, but not so much because of what I'm not talking about this. I'm just experiencing this very, very poignantly. Throw the fish out, and I'm like, not relieved, but I did something. And then a seagull comes down, scoops the fish, flies off with it. In that moment, I knew I never could fish again. I can't do it. Now, if I was starving, my children were starving, that might change. Maybe, I don't know. But it was just like, oh, I can't do that. That's what happens to people when they see the power of their actions to not only affect their internal world, your feelings and thoughts, but to affect other living creatures. So let's be very clear about this. Instead of getting into judgment, there are livelihoods that promote peace and harmony that do not harm others or oneself in this world. And most of them are readily available, and we're engaged in them. Okay? So what the Buddha was saying is that if you want to get it together, if you want to see what you really are, you need to take care of your outer actions. You need to take care of your livelihood. You need to not kill other living things. That's what hit me that day. This was a big lesson in right action. The biggest part of right action is don't kill, don't harm. Now it gets a little bit more subtle. Right speech, what does that mean? Don't lie. Don't deceive. Don't slander. And then it goes into a little bit more subtle place. Don't gossip. Now the Buddha, having lived his career, teaching career, and those who were with him, in a pretty, you might say, in a certain sense, protected setting. Like these monks, they stayed together, they moved together, they lived outdoors. You know, they were interacting with the larger society, they were interacting with it regularly, but they had their seclusion, they had their refuge. Right? So what did they talk about? Well, if they weren't silent, they talked about their direct experience. Now, if everybody in this room decided today, for the rest of your life, only talk about your direct experience, about 85% of what we talk about will go away, just like that. Or somewhere around that, maybe. So with this right speech, you get a chance to look at, what am I talking about and why am I talking about it? Who am I talking about? And sometimes you talk a certain way about somebody because you're making a joke. You know, it's one thing to talk about somebody in a way that sort of, in a way, enhances them. That if they were to hear that, they would thank you. It's another thing to talk about somebody where if they heard that, it would upset them. You see, and in our society, we talk very freely about all kinds of different things, don't we? Because this is called the land of the free and the brave. It's our right to talk, freedom of speech. And so people will sometimes be on the television, big spot on the television, and they're slandering other people, and they're being paid tons of money to do it. But if you look at the motivation behind the action, behind the work, behind the speech, you get in touch with things. In my case, my unconsciousness about my motivation in the fishing, parts of it, were completely blind to me. So one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, was in the Peace Corps when he was first over in the East. He was in Thailand, he was in the Peace Corps, and he hadn't really meditated much. He'd heard about the Dharma, but hadn't really meditated. And for some reason, in that time in the Peace Corps, they took these volunteers off to the big island of Hawaii, and what they did out there was teach them to kill chickens. Just teach them to kill chickens. They take a chicken, cut the head off. So, you know, that's what they were doing, and the peer pressure, you know, I'm in the Corps, this is what we're doing. So he gets up and he takes his turn. He chops the head off the chicken. Years later, when he's meditating, this is coming back like technicolor, and it's agonizing. It's absolutely agonizing to just feel how out of it he was to do this thing, to just take this chicken and go, whoa. And he goes for breakfast. And he goes to crack his egg, his so-called hard-boiled egg. And there's an embryo chicken in the egg. This comes to him in the midst of him experiencing the anguish and the grief of having sort of blindly chop the head off this chicken because other people said, chop the head off this chicken. He never got, and maybe nobody got, why are we even doing this? They didn't explain it. They just, we're going to the big island, we're going to chop the chickens. You got to learn this. And nobody really asked. Is this what happened in World War II? Did people just listen and follow what somebody else was saying to do? Do this now. Do it. Or if you don't do this, we're going to do this to you. You want to talk about madness? There you go. So it becomes very powerful to just pause and go, okay, without getting critical and judgmental and hard on myself, what kind of actions am I involved in? What kind of speech am I involved in? And my livelihood. Take a firm look at that. You see, it's very powerful. Without getting judgmental or moralistic, you actually take a look at what's called your outer discipline. If you want to understand discipleship, if you want to understand what a disciple is, you need to understand what discipline really means, what restraint means. Because otherwise you can be tumbling through things and you could be taking actions like I was with the fishing for so many years and not really getting the connection to life at that level that I got when the fish swallowed the hook and I went through that experience. Now let's be realistic too. You walk out of this house tonight and you walk across the grass, you're going to kill things because there's little things down there that are moving around that you can't see that you're going to step on. Okay? So what you do is you don't intentionally kill. And this gets tricky for people. It's like, well, what about vegetarianism? What about being in a chain of people and up here somebody butchered and down here it got passed and then I'm eating this? Okay, and people can get like really neurotic about this. And why are there monks right now all over this world who are eating what is given to them? They're eating chicken, they're eating meat, they're eating fish because it's what's given to them. They're not killing the chicken, the fish, or the cow, but they're eating it. See, what's interesting is you get to find out for yourself what works if you take the time to really look. Not making some kind of fixed set of rules here. You get to find out through your mindfulness, through your living experience, what does right action, right speech, right livelihood mean, and how does it work? And in a way, you could think of these as common sense, right? This is just like right there in the heart of all the world's religious traditions. It's like ethical living. It hasn't always come out that way. And there's all kinds of extremes that have appeared over time and history. But it's common sense not to harm. Because if I harm someone else, I'm harming myself at the same time. Because I'm connected to that other being. And ultimately, that other being and I are one, not two. That's the ultimate truth. So I don't want to sound too serious on this stuff. Okay? Some people go, oh my gosh, I got to quit my job. Oh my gosh, I have so many bad actors. I'm not going to talk. Can't trust myself. I've been slandering all my friends when they're not around. And they've been slandering you too. So once that's somewhat clear, it helps you very much in settling down. Because if you distort your already distorted mind with actions and speech that create more conflict, that generate more greed and fear in your mind, then when you go to meditate, you'll experience that. You'll experience the fruit of your actions. It will come up. This is part of the meaning of karma. What you sow, you reap. And the depth of that, the actual profundity of that, we can't even think about the interconnectedness there. We cannot think about the multitude of actions that we've engaged in, the multitude of effects those actions will have, just in a day. Never mind a year or a lifetime. It's just really quite subtle, deep, profound, and beyond our comprehension. The law of cause and effect. The right energy or effort, the mindfulness, right mindfulness and right concentration, the outer discipline of the action, the livelihood and the speech leads to the inner discipline of the meditation. Right energy. If you're interested in these things, you apply your energy to the method or practice, lifestyle that can actually assist you in realization or assist you in awakening. Okay? So we all have energy here right now. You direct or you bring that energy together. You center that energy. You bring it into the meditation process. You bring it into cultivating. And what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness. You observe the body in the body. You observe the body not as a concept, but a direct experience. You begin to feel the living life of the body as sensation and breathing. You experience the feeling in the feeling, which means you experience the feelings as they really are, not as concept, but direct, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling, rising and passing in every moment. You experience the mind in the mind, which means you see thoughts for what they are, which is free from judgment, commentary, interference. You see thoughts, really. You see what this thing we call mind is. You see states of mind, particularly aversion and desire and confusion. You begin to see those powerful forces directly. That means to experience the mind in the mind. We could all say we're experiencing our mind right now, but to see the mind clearly with mindfulness illuminates that. You see it for what it is. And those are tastes of freedom. Anytime you see something for what it really is, there's a taste of freedom there, small or large. It's like you, whatever you think of yourself as, you sort of pop open. There's an opening that happens there. And then, of course, the fourth foundation. Okay. The hindrances, six sense bases, the five aggregates, seven factors of awakening, and of course then it leads into the noble truths. Now, why do you do this meditation? You do it so you can penetrate through distorted perception. You cannot realize what right view is until you have seen what distorted perception is. So this right now is really the crown jewel of the Buddhist teachings. And I've mentioned it before here, but we want to go a little bit further with it. And that is this. You get a direct experiential understanding or realization of the three marks of existence. You see experientially at both a gross and subtle level what impermanence is. You see at a gross and subtle level what unsatisfactoriness is. And then the crown jewel. You see at a gross and subtle level what no self really means. Okay. Let's take each of those. Okay, because in order for right view, which is the culmination of the Eightfold Path, it's the culmination of a life of awakening. Right, what's called right view, or samma. Samma means right. Ditti means view. Change or impermanence. What is the gross level of that? The gross level of impermanence is everything has a beginning and an end. The sentence has a beginning and an end. The breath has a beginning and an end. Thought has a beginning and an end. Feeling has a beginning and an end. Everything has a beginning and an end. The meditation gives you access to that experientially. So you're not just thinking about it. Again, you see it. You know it. It's clear. Beginning, end. In the meditation, right, it often will start with something simple like the breathing. And people clearly see the beginning and the end of the breath. Try it right now without necessarily closing your eyes or doing anything special. Don't interfere with the breath, but just observe the breathing and notice that there's the in-breath and it has a beginning and an end. And the out-breath, it has a beginning and an end. Anybody not have access to that? Do we have to close our eyes again and get a little more focused? It's right there. Okay, all other experiences, thoughts, sense experiences, feelings, behavior, actions have a beginning and an end. The subtle level of impermanence. In between the beginning and the end, all there is transition. What does this do? As this dawns, as this becomes clear, grasping, clinging, holding on to things, spontaneously lets go. That's the consequence or the result of seeing clearly what impermanence actually is. Is that clear? Yeah. You want to say more?
Say it again.
Yeah. Seeing clearly both the obvious or gross level of impermanence, which is that everything has a beginning and an end, John, and the subtle level, which means seeing that in between the beginning and the end, all there is transition. All there is change. You see, for some people, they see the beginning of the breath and the end of the breath, or they see the beginning of the thought and the end of the thought, or the beginning of the mood. They actually saw the beginning of the mood. They got moody at 8:05. They felt it come on. They got a little funky. And then by about 2 that afternoon, for some reason that they can't comprehend, it sort of went poof. But they missed what happened in between because they were doing a lot of other things. Defending against the mood, busy working, talking to somebody, eating, doing jumping jacks, whatever. Okay, they missed the subtle level. What happens in the meditation is you see the gross level or the obvious level, and you see the subtle level. Bang! The consequence is the tendency to hold and to grasp onto things dissipates. It's amazing. And then unsatisfactoriness. Okay, this is another way to talk about suffering. We talked about dukkha or suffering in previous weeks. The gross level of unsatisfactoriness is that if everything's changing, if everything has a beginning and an end and only transition in between, if that's the truth of the way things really are, then how can you have satisfaction from a transitory condition? How can you have lasting fulfillment from something that's impermanent? You can't. That's actually, that could sound subtle, but that's actually considered the obvious level or gross level. What is the subtle level of unsatisfactoriness? When there is grasping at the 5 aggregates as self, what are the 5 aggregates? Body, feeling, perception, mental formations, thoughts, and consciousness. Okay? You're grasping at or identifying yourself as something that is constantly changing, that is impermanent. Must mean, has to conclude that that's going to be unsatisfactory. Okay? Let me repeat that. The gross level of unsatisfactoriness is because everything is changing, everything has a beginning and an end with only transition in between, clinging or grasping at that, attempting to gain fulfillment from any sense experience, from any feeling, from any thought. And I mean lasting fulfillment, not just temporary, because everybody has temporary fulfillment from pleasant feelings in this room. Everybody has transitory or temporary fulfillment from getting a letter in the mail from somebody who remembers you and sends this nice snail mail letter and writes love at the end. I talked to a friend from the UK yesterday. In the middle of the conversation, she's a good friend and she loves this stuff. She said, "I love you." And I said, "I love you too." And it was this moment, boom. But beginning, middle, end, boom, gone. There's no lasting fulfillment in that. It's just, it's a hit. Want to find out what lasting fulfillment is? There's a way. It's called the Dharma. The subtle level of unsatisfactoriness is that if there is grasping and clinging at the 5 aggregates as yourself, you will be guaranteed disappointment. Why? Because every moment of your life, you are experiencing ongoing birth and death. This process that we're talking about of impermanence is happening extremely fast. We are only seeing a fraction of it. When you get quiet and concentrated in meditation, you begin to see what's happening so clearly, it literally blows your mind. It blows your concept right out of the water. And it replaces it with the truth of the way things really are, which is not just that things are coming and going, but every moment of our lives we are experiencing subtle and sometimes not so subtle existential loss. We are experiencing little tiny tastes of dying right now. People say, well, I've got a great job, I have a healthy body, I love my work, I live where I want, I have great friends, my children are healthy. Those people who say, I have a great life, perfect life, my life is, they are experiencing the same existential loss as the person who feels misery, who has not those so-called good things. We're all in it together. That's why the rich are miserable, and some of the rich are happy, and the poor are miserable, and some of the poor are happy. It isn't based on what you have. It's based on what you understand. And the crown jewel, what does no self mean? The gross level of no self means everything that's happening is arising because of specific and actually incomprehensible conditions. You could say that if something clicks in this talk and makes her smile and do her hands like that or whatever, that it was partly because of something that was said. Little tiny fraction of truth there. The conditions that give rise to whatever is happening is so unbelievably, mysteriously, interconnectedly vast that we cannot comprehend. That's why we can't get why things are the way they are. But we can feel into that, come to know that, so we don't have to understand it intellectually. So the notion of a self, of a Paul who is separate from life and negotiating his way through it, that particular formation of feeling, perception, mind-body process arises because of particular conditions. The meditation makes this clear. You see in your meditation the arising of the perception of a self that's separate from things. A me or an I. You actually see that. You see it as a thought or a perception or even a belief. And sometimes it's a feeling. There's the feeling of me. This comes clear. The subtle level of no self. If everything is changing, there is no solidity. And grasping at the five aggregates as yourself eventually shows itself to produce unhappiness, stress, tension. The subtle level of no self means that actually nothing exists the way you think it does, because existence equates to duration in time. Everything that's happening is happening actually as both form and emptiness simultaneously. Everything that's happening is empty of self. There's no I or me in anything that's happening. We become often clear about impermanence but shy away from unsatisfactoriness. When we really settle and look, we can see that our circumstance is unsatisfactory. And it initially is a very, very shocking thing for some people to get that. It rocks your world to really feel that the things that you've been doing and the way you've been doing it, yes, it brings some satisfaction, but it's transitory. And you begin to feel the sting, very deep sting of that truth. And some people at that point turn away. I saw a guy that turned away from meditation after 20 years of intensive meditation. He just left it and he went back into the life that he'd been living before. And then he came back after 2 years of retreat into the world, I guess you could call it. And he said, with such a beautiful tone in his voice, he said, I'm back. And the way he said it was so compelling to me, because I imagined that he had really just gone on a bender. And he was back. I have a friend who called from Massachusetts. He's been in intensive meditation for quite a number of months. I didn't even recognize his voice. And he's a real dear friend. I had to ask, who are you? He said, you don't know who I am? You don't recognize my voice? And it started to kind of like, are you? And it was like this so dear friend. He'd changed so much. He said, but I'm not free yet. Storms are still coming. That was his way of describing the difficulties. The big difficulty, the central difficulty, is the belief that you are the five aggregates. You are the body, feeling, perception, consciousness, and mental formation. When it's clear that these things have a beginning, middle, and an end, something loosens. When it's clear that there is no lasting satisfaction in any form, what happens is you begin to get a sense of what emptiness really means. It doesn't mean that form, as we experience it, just goes away. And it doesn't mean that all of a sudden you have x-ray eyes and you start seeing through people's legs. Okay, or the wall is suddenly just particles. No, it looks pretty much the same. Okay? Pretty much the same. Sometimes it goes a little like that, like it didn't before. You know, it seems a little like alive, like it didn't before. Sometimes. But that doesn't have to happen. That's not a requirement. Okay? What happens is those things that are actually causing pain and suffering in your life, they become replaced by, or they transform into what? What does it mean to realize there is no self? It means that this space of emptiness, the form is appearing as. See, this is actually, in a way, just emptiness. We call it form, and we think of the air as the emptiness, the space. These things are empty. All of this is empty of separation from anything else. This floor is touching everything. These hands are touching everything. Everything is touching everything else. There is no separation. What happens as that emptiness, that form is appearing as, becomes clear is that that which used to be happening, that you took as yourself, that you believed you were, that you struggled with, tried to overcome, all that stuff that you so-called used to do, becomes replaced by what? Absence of a perception of a separate self means what's here is love, compassion, kindness, interest, ease. And as a byproduct of that, this body-mind process tends to work better. It's still going to fall apart, but it tends to work better as a byproduct. Still have discomforts in the body, still have emotions that come, still have thoughts that might seem kooky, but it's clear that you do not have to do anything about them. You don't have to get away from them. You don't have to change them. They're just unfolding. See, the view of self requires duration of form in time. And what I'm saying to you is that in a way, this is a stretch, but in a way, nothing exists as you think it does. Nothing exists as you think it does. Notice the perception of separation in this room. That's a perception. I'm sitting over here, Sean's sitting over there. We're separate. Time and space separates us. Okay? And that's a very, very agreed upon, discussed, believed in, invested in idea. Okay, what happens in the meditation is Sean is still there, Paul is still here, but instead of experiencing and identifying and feeling all the kind of things that I may have used to feel about relationship, like let's say he's particularly articulate, and I have always felt myself to be not all that capable of speaking well, and he speaks up, and I feel my insecurity, I feel my less than, I feel my judgment, this stuff goes away. And what's there is a connectedness, where even if people are not being very nice, the mind stops reacting to it, and there's a feeling of love, and there's a feeling of understanding, and there's a feeling of freedom from comparison. These Brahma Viharas, compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, equanimity, they happen more and more freely and naturally because that's the consequence of freedom from a separate self. So whatever turmoils you might have in your mind, these turmoils are seen as just an unfolding process that doesn't have any solidity to it. They're unsatisfactory because they can't bring lasting happiness. And there's no one who owns them. And then you don't have to try to be loving and compassionate. Like, I wasn't trying to have an insight into stop killing fish. It just happened. You could say I was ripe. Joseph, my teacher, wasn't trying to, have an insight into the harm that killing chickens can bring him. What he was trying to do, actually, was comprehend how the heck he could have taken himself into a position where he chopped the chicken's head off. And we don't want to walk out of here judging the farmers. There's people who are doing this. It's like, you know, it's not going to help them, us, or anybody to start judging them and have some kind of spiritual ego that because, you know, you're not killing and your neighbor is, that you're in a better place than they are. Questions?